TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Star Trek Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, look, man, I told you to stop scratching it.
But Chris, it's just, it's so frustrating, and that cream you gave me smells, and I can't take it anymore, Chris.
Well, I'm sorry, Matthew, but the more you scratch it, the longer it will take to heal. So you're going to have to deal with it.
Ugh, fine.
And then I also wanted to mention, you know, if it keeps stinging, there could be a reason for that. It's because today we're talking about Rajin.
That fits pretty stinking perfectly. Yeah, that's a nice pull there. I love that.
All right, everyone. We are continuing our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise today with the fourth episode of season 3, Rajin. And here is a quick rundown. While the Zindi Council continues to debate how best to destroy Earth, the Enterprise welcomes aboard a beautiful passenger. Archer rescued the lingerie-clad alien from a slave market on the Zenathan planet, where he, Tucker, and Reed sought clues about the Zindi and a way to synthesize Trillium-D. It turns out that the freed woman may not have the information they need, but she does have ulterior motives, and the hots for everyone. Things take an even weirder turn when the Zindi reptilians and insectoids show up, looking for their electric Barbarella. So, Matthew, this story is, I mean, it centers a lot on the Zindi Council, on their deliberations on what to do to make sure Earth doesn't come after them in the future. And their overall motivations, I feel as a viewer, like if I jump into this episode as we're doing right now, watching it episode by episode, I'm feeling like I'm not quite clear why they're so concerned about Earth, because the writers have deliberately left us in the dark at this point to try to build up the mystery and the tension. But do you feel like that's working at this point?
You know, I think that's a good question. And I do think that for myself, it is working so far. And part of that is that I think of the way it's written, this is actually pretty genius in this way, because we're being inserted into these council meetings, and obviously they've already had these discussions. And so the fact that we're not just kind of like having a big, huge info dump during this, you know, it's like we're just getting a taste of the council meetings as they're happening now. And obviously they've already made the decision to attack Earth for some reason. But the point of this is to really show us the way in which the council is not completely aligned, even though they do have this mission, and to create this bifurcation of the and not even that. I mean, there's more factions than that in
it's
the sense
that it's a bifurcation method.
Yes. And you know, that this splintering of different groups here within this very unique setup of an alien species, right? And so I think that's kind of the thing that really gets to you. And you get the sense that, too, and this is why I think it works for me and why I think the writing here actually in this episode is pretty well done, is because you get the sense of, okay, there's a reason they're all doing this, but they don't necessarily agree on the way in which to actually make this happen. Mm-hmm. And there's these different factions of wanting to do it with a bioweapon and another with basically like a spherical, Death Star type of thing. And I love the sense that And I think what this really does is this just gives us the opportunity to realize, okay, there are cracks here in the Zindi species between, you know, the different, it's an entire species, but they have subspecies within that. But there's cracks in that. And therefore, it's already setting up kind of where the series is going to go by the end of the season, that we're going to exploit those cracks. Mm-hmm. And we're going to utilize them to most likely be able to curtail what's going to happen. And so, you know, I think this is actually a pretty, I mean, even though this episode is slightly, and we'll talk about it, it is a little bit kind of odd and off-putting, but I think it's done in a way to which we're getting all the information we need now for this episode, but we're also getting all this information that's helping us build a resume for the Zindi themselves. And so I don't know. I don't want to spoil it for anyone. Not my favorite episode of the season, but it's also one of those episodes where it's like, well, if you took this out, it wouldn't make sense because so much of the plot hinges on what happens in this episode.
Yeah. And I'm realizing, as you mentioned, council meetings, that Enterprise has traded the Next Generation's staff meetings for council meetings at this point.
Yes.
Don't we all love to sit in on and get glimpses of council meetings. But yeah, like you say, if you take this episode out of the context of the season and just watch it as a standalone episode, I would say overall it doesn't work because there's something specific to the overall story, which is getting information about humans to pass back to the Zindi Council.
Right.
And the fact that they need to synthesize Trillium D to protect the ship because they're on this journey in the Expanse. There are elements of the story that do stand on their own, but those elements are like they're pulled from the grab bag of go-to story elements for Star Trek over all the years. The idea of an alien coming on the ship that can somehow telepathically, or in the case of Rajin, I call her tricorder hands. Because how cool would it be if you had tricorders built into both of your hands and you could just analyze anything by touching it inappropriately at times? But, these kind of aliens or this kind of story element, it could work, but it doesn't make for a very compelling story because it's something that we've seen over and over. And I'm not sure that encountering this alien woman is that compelling even within the context of the season, because I don't know, it puts Archer in a kind of familiar situation, and I think the overall episode is like a puzzle piece. I almost feel like I'm jumping to the end here. Maybe I am. It feels like a puzzle piece in the overall story that, it needs to be there. It helps to advance the motivations of the Zindi. But it also leaves you feeling kind of like it doesn't have closure as an episode. And I feel like if we look at Deep Space Nine, which does have a lot of episodes that are very important for the overall narrative, most of those stories still feel self-contained enough that, yes, they're advancing this long narrative, but you can still watch them and, for the most part, you don't really have to know everything that's happening in the overall story to still come away feeling like you got something out of the episode.
So I definitely understand what you're saying, but I think that I take it slightly differently in this, that, you know, this is, we know all of the Star Trek tropes, but Archer doesn't know all the Star Trek tropes. And I think one of the things that actually makes this interesting is that this helps build into the season the storyline for Archer here in this episode, right? His humanity, his goodwill is taken advantage of, right?
Yeah.
And seeing this woman wrong done, or at least he thinks that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And he never stops to question whether or not, you know, that, oh, is that just so convenient that this is happening mm-hmm. this way, right? He doesn't even have a thought process as to that being the case, that could even be the case. And so mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that makes this actually a really interesting episode, is when you look at it through that lens of the characterization of Archer and how he's going to change throughout the season, this is actually an important linchpin for him moving to a place where he is going to become much less trusting and much less forgiving mm-hmm. when it comes to what people are doing, and, you know, whether or not he can be taken advantage of, because here he is clearly taken advantage of in that way. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, it almost destroys a member of his crew. You know, T'Pol is injured in a way that she could have mm-hmm. ended up dead. And
there is a crew member who probably was killed, although it's not made yes. clear by.
True.
100%.
Yeah. Yep. And not only that, but what we see here is, an unbeknownst to Archer, we'll see in a later episode how this kind of plays out and plays into what the Zindi plans are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what makes this actually really interesting, right? What happens here, his altruism towards this young lady almost gets the entire human race killed. And that's the beauty, actually, I think, of this episode, is that as we watch Archer get kind of harder and harder as a character, you know, his heart mm-hmm. seems to calcify, you know, throughout the yeah. season. And it's not unearned, right? Because mm-hmm. What he's finding is that maybe sometimes a part of his humanity needs to be turned off. Mm-hmm. And this is the big question of this whole season, right? When everything you know is on the line, when legitimately your entire species existence is on the line, what would you do to save them? How mm-hmm. far would you go? And I think that's the question that this whole season, of course, wrestles with on purpose, because when it was coming out right around 9/11 and after that, and questions we were dealing with ourselves. But mm-hmm. I also think it's just an incredibly salient question for the human species as a whole. And so I think, again, I don't necessarily think that your take on it there is wrong. Mm-hmm. I have to put myself in the sense of, like, yeah, this is before all the stuff I know, and mm-hmm. what they're, and then also with our knowledge, I actually mm-hmm. think that this becomes a rather important episode, even though it might not be my favorite of the season. They're using it to really build the character of Archer and where he's going to go.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. And it is true that they gradually move Archer in that direction over the course of the season. So he doesn't come into the season with a rage or a distrust or others. He's not the captain we see at the end of the season.
Right.
At the beginning. And they don't flip a switch either. They do mm-hmm. gradually move him in that direction based on the things that happen to him, which
yeah.
Is really good. And in a way, I can also see that connecting with Hoshi's character development in this episode as well. It's not as obvious or anything, but just as you talk about that, and then as we think about where Hoshi will end up by the end of the season,
mm-hmm.
the way she is so welcoming to Rajin, she seems a little suspicious, actually, I think, the way that Linda Park plays that moment. Mm-hmm. The fact that Hoshi, you know, reaches out her hand to shake hands. And
yeah.
after we've already seen what Rajin can do, you're thinking, no, Hoshi, don't give her your hand. You know, you're just, she's going to scan you. Don't do it. But, mm-hmm. but I can see a little bit there as well. And as for the, yeah, you mentioned this season as a reaction to the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States and the Zindi weapon attack on Florida is an obvious parallel to what happened. But the bioweapon being developed here also connects with what was going on at the time, too, because in the aftermath of that attack, there was the whole question about weapons of mass destruction and then what was going on with Iraq, allegedly. And so there was this fear, anyway, of other weapons of mass destruction. And you can see that being written into the story as well as it moves along. And of course, this isn't the last time that we will hear about the bioweapon, but it is the last time that we'll hear, it's not the last time we'll hear about Rajin, because Archer will mention her before, but we won't see her again, which I find kind of curious here, because they left it open at the end of the episode. We don't know what happens to her. We feel like, or at least I feel like as a viewer, based on what happens here, that there's a good chance that we might encounter her again, but she doesn't come back. Do you think that was a missed opportunity for the storytelling and what you'd mentioned in terms of how she affected Archer?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that this episode does is that it does leave open the possibility for her to, of course, come back, right? And I think that's good. But it also reminds me of all the things I think that we have talked about with Deep Space Nine, that they left a lot of threads for themselves to be able to pull on.
Mm-hmm.
They did not, of course, necessarily pull on every single thread, because I think a lot of times they found that they didn't need that thread, right? And so I think that if they had felt like she was important to the story, I think that there is a definitely they could have moved forward with that. But I think what happened is they just realized, okay, we don't really need her to complete this story. Which, again, I think is great in that sense. Like, you know, the season is one that kind of gets complicated as we move forward anyway. And so to not utilize her in any other way, shape, or form, I think it's not a bad thing. Could it have been really interesting, you know, to have her come back? I think absolutely, right? You know, that could have been fascinating to maybe have her come in with her knowledge of the Zindi and be able to help them in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think she was necessary. And so, but like you said, it's the great part of actually the writing here that again, I think is, should be praised. You give yourself every opportunity to figure out where the season's going to go. I'm sure in the writer's room at this point, they're still feeling things out.
Mm-hmm.
And so to give yourself as many options as possible is always smart. And so Rajin is definitely an option. They could have a thread they could have pulled on, and they just didn't need to. So
I can imagine this story being written today in how modern Star Trek has worked. Discovery, for example, where Archer would encounter her again later. And or even the way Picard was written, he could encounter her later and she would end up being a critical piece to solving the mystery and stopping the bioweapon and so forth. So, yeah, they had different directions they could have gone in. I think the way her powers are presented in this episode is a bit muddy as well in terms of how it was described. If you look at some, there aren't a lot of notes about this episode, but I've seen some notes about the descriptions of her and how her powers were supposed to work. And one of them said that she had a seductive power in her ability to block any memory of what she's done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that came through, because I feel like people did have a memory of being of their encounter with her to some extent. And also they talk a lot about her telepathy, and But there's the moment where when Phlox, when she comes on the ship and Phlox scans her eyes and he says something like, you have the most unusual eyes or incredible eyes or something like that. When you watch her approach people, it does seem that it's the eye contact initially that creates, it like puts people, it's like hypnotic almost. And then she does her tricorder hand thing and all. And the two seem to go together, but I don't know that it's always clear how she is seducing people in the episode.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in that, in the sense that it is a little fudged and as to how it's actually happening. I do think it does seem pretty clear to me, though, that people do seem to have some sort of recollection that something has happened. Mm-hmm. And that it was pleasant, but they don't necessarily quite know what it was, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems to be something that leaves them with a good feeling towards her in their mind because of that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I think that's actually something that's really interesting about the episode. And of course, it's one of those things where, like, you almost feel like you've had a little bit more time to kind of delve into that and her as a character and everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I think what makes this interesting in a lot of ways is the ability to have a new alien species that, you know, has interesting powers that we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. It's very alien. It's very different. You know, I think it also makes the expanse seem all the more creepy and kind of mm-hmm. crazy. I think it also... it takes something that we all, it makes it very horror movie-ish, you know, this mm-hmm. idea of taking something so wonderful and intimate of human sexuality and intersexuality in general and turning it into a weapon like this. Mm-hmm. And so that, and turning it into a weapon on, you know, either sex, male or female, mm-hmm. is kind of terrifying. And so I think that's something that kind of works about the episode in that sense. If you just kind of, as a straightforward, like, horror type movie, this is kind of like that, you know, first rule of a horror movie is don't have sex, right? Cause you end up dead. And mm-hmm. that's what makes this so kind of unsettling and creepy, which is in some ways good for the season, because that's exactly what's happening in the expanse in general.
Mm, yeah. I thought the first rule of horror movies was don't answer the phone.
I think that's just Scream, but
and don't answer the door.
That too.
Don't turn off the light.
Exactly.
There's a whole list of
so
rules.
So many. Actually, there's just so many rules.
Right. So. Don't eat that.
Exactly.
But yeah. No, it's yeah. The other thing that was mentioned about her, there's some unused dialogue where T'Pol mentioned that it's not in the actual episode, where T'Pol would mention that there was something like physically invasive about mm-hmm. Rajin's telepathy, that it was beyond the mind meld. So that would make sense coming from a Vulcan, beyond the mind meld. And it makes me curious about her species. They don't really expand at all on what her world is like or anything, but she's from a planet called Orantaku. And it seemed, what I wonder is, does she have special abilities herself, or are these abilities common to her species? Because mm-hmm. if they are, I can see other species who are information brokers who right. would kidnap members of her yep. race as children and then use them to gain the information that they need and then sell it, which would, you know, put her and her people in a position of being very susceptible to being pulled into slavery because of some natural ability that they have.
Right. Yeah. You know, one of the things too, in talking about Rajin as well, we don't get anything really about her past, you know, but we do get the sense that in many ways she's a sex slave. That mm-hmm. she's been sold into sex slavery, which, you know, at that point in history I don't think many people were necessarily thinking of or are completely aware of. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, today we realize how pervasive that is in our world and that it's happening all the time. And it's kind of terrifying that that's the case. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate in some ways the fact that this episode, you know, we can look back on it now and actually see some relevance to it as a, as an episode that you might not have necessarily thought of then. And I think that's kind of wonderful in that sense and terribly sad that that's also the case, that we could, you know, see more relevance to that. And so, yeah, I got to give him credit here because, you know, the more we've kind of talked about the episode in that sense, I think there are a lot of things here. And I guess what it kind of comes to in many ways is that, oh, I just kind of wish that we had gotten the opportunity to maybe dig in just a little bit more to her as a character, because I think that it would have made the episode just a little bit better if that type of thematic element could actually be hit a little bit harder in this episode. I think it makes it a more hard hitting episode emotionally and just kind of story wise for us as the audience, because we realize, you know, she's being forced into it. She doesn't want to do this, but it's like, I do this or I die, you know, and in many ways, what it makes is a great juxtaposition between her choice and what Archer's doing, right? And that question of how far would you go to survive? Yeah. And so I think all of those things are here in the episode, but I think what it goes to show is this, that, you know, when you only have 42 minutes per episode, this is the place where kind of streaming helps, and it allows you to say, you know, maybe this episode actually would be better as a 50-minute episode than a 42-minute episode, and that just a little bit more time allows you to be able to unpack some of these elements for the character to really kind of like just hit home, oh my gosh, this is a character who's being forced into the same situation that Archer is, but just from the other side, and you then have more of a feeling sorry for her than just being upset at her for taking advantage of the Enterprise and her crew and Archer, T'Pol and the rest. And so, you know,
Well,
kinda,
I mean, she's
kind of cool.
She's clearly unwilling. She's doing this unwillingly. And you also get the impression that she's had to do things like this repeatedly in her life unwillingly, and she's just basically being dragged along by others and forced to use her powers for other people. I think that, yeah, your point about streaming is important, that they could do that today. I do think there are ways within the constraints of the 42 minutes that they had to make her character a little bit richer and to clear up some of the small points that would strengthen the episode. I mean, for one thing, you could shorten the fight scenes in the corridors with the Zindi.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, which, you know, some fans would say, no, that's the cool part. And I think the fact that that's not something that they did, that they chose to extend those fight scenes to the length that they did versus taking, you know, and you don't need a lot of time in the writing, right? You get back 20 seconds, you can do stuff throughout the episode to strengthen a character, but you would do it in quiet moments. And that's where, if I look back, especially at The Next Generation, that's how they would write something. DS9 would also do that. If you look at Discovery, it's like action, action, action. And so when I look at something like this in the third season of Enterprise, it feels like we're in this transition from an older style of Star Trek storytelling to a newer style of Star Trek storytelling. Yeah. So they certainly could have done a bit more with the character here.
Well, and to your point, and I think it's a really good one, that whole idea of like maybe cutting down on some of the action sequences there at the end. 100%. Because I'm watching the end of the episode and I was thinking to myself, okay, why is this going on so long? Why? Mm-hmm. Honestly, that's what I was thinking. I was like, this is kind of nuts, man. This is ridiculously long for no good reason. I think that you are 100% correct in that. It does make me kind of wish like that there was a special edition of this episode where we kind of re-edited it. So we cut some of those down. And we got just a little bit more of the character moments, because really we're talking when on television, we tend to think of like 1 to 2 minutes is like not being very much. But in storytelling time on television, that's an eternity. What you can do with some character moments in even 30 seconds. And so, yeah, I think this is definitely a place where that would have been really nice to have had. And again, I think it only enhances the episode. And instead of maybe being, who knows where we're going to be, but instead of being maybe a 3-star episode, it's a 4-star episode, you know, depending on where we land.
Well, I think the reason for it is probably that they felt some pressure to add more action to Star Trek at that time. And also they wanted to show off the special effects that they were able to do, because one thing, even though some of it doesn't necessarily look spectacular, like the insectoid moment, for example, compared with today's television, at the time it was very groundbreaking, and Enterprise was really pushing visual effects on TV sci-fi forward in this season. And so I think that's one reason they might do it. While we're talking about characters, we do open the episode with more Trip and T'Pol, and we get a neuropressure scene again. We have them discussing how their time spent together is perceived by others. And then later in the episode, we see them working together, trying to synthesize the Trillium D, which I found interesting knowing what's going to happen, because knowing how that compound affects T'Pol and changes the trajectory of her life as a drug, essentially, here she's involved in the creation of the very thing that's going to have such an impact on her later.
I it's interesting because I feel like in this early season, what they're doing is such a great job of actually progressing this relationship. And you can understand why Jolene and Connor get very frustrated with the relationship as it plays out, because it seems as though for no reason other than the, I guess, the moonlighting effect where, oh, what happens if we get these characters together and then what do we do with them? You know, it's like, well, you have plenty of places to go, because this would be the first Vulcan and human relationship that we have on record, and watching that play out would be incredibly interesting. And watching them navigate that, you know, all of that, I think, would be incredibly fun, you know. And instead, what we kind of get is them starting off this relationship and really doing a great job of continuing to progress it, even with the conversation they have here about whether or not it's anybody else's business of whether or not they should be in this relationship, you know, and or are they having a relationship and all that. So, you know, it is just a frustrating thing. And so I...
But it is good that they're spending time in each episode laying the foundation for
the
relationship, like bit by bit.
I couldn't agree with you more. Like, I think it's that's what I'm saying. It's so great that they're doing that. The frustrating thing is that it's really not going to go anywhere by the end of the season. And even in the next season, it's going to get even more frustrating. And so it's just like... they couldn't commit, and it's funny that that's the case, because Deep Space Nine showed us so well that you can do great relationships with characters while at the same time making a great show. It's not mutually exclusive, right? And I think that's pretty frustrating that they just wouldn't commit to the relationship. You know, I think we as fans were kind of willing to commit to the relationship at this point. The actors were willing to commit to the material. Mm-hmm. It's just like the writer's like, oh, I don't know. And it's like, dude, come on, just commit already. Mm-hmm. They have commitment issues.
Yeah, I was imagining rewriting the dialogue just a little bit to tie into the crew a little bit more. Instead of it being Reed who's wondering what's going on, maybe Trip could tell to Paul that, you know, Travis isn't really thrilled about how we're navigating our relationship.
Oh, man.
Because, you know, he'd be most concerned about that kind of thing. But yeah, no, I get the points about their relationship. And yeah, I don't know. The writer's always dancing around who they're going to pair up and whether they'll commit to it anyway. And I think in Star Trek, it's a lot harder for the writers to really commit to something like that, which is amazing, which is what makes it amazing what they did on DS9. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they put together some characters that you wouldn't expect, and they actually turned those into real full-fledged realistic relationships.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing about that is too, Deep Space Nine did not deny the fact that romantic relationships and those type of relationships are incredibly important to our lives, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, TNG had this problem, right? It could not commit to giving relationships to its characters like Troy and Riker. You know, it, for some reason in the last season, we get Troy and Worf in a relationship, but, you know.
And if we had gotten Riker and Worf in a relationship, that would have been.
Different show, different
a
show.
Really interesting episode.
Yes, but yeah. I think, you know, Deep Space Nine finally just, like, we're going to commit to the bit of and that's a bad way to say it, but we're going to allow our characters to experience the thing that almost every other human being on the planet experiences. Like, there, you know, mm-hmm. there are very few people who just kind of have never been in some kind of romantic relationship at all, and it hasn't been important to them. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, it's kind of one of those annoying things, you know, as you rewatch a show, and, you know, obviously hindsight's 20/20, but even for them, as they're writing this, they shouldn't need a lot of hindsight. You know, they should just feel confident and go for it with their characters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, one last thing I want to point out is that how I felt the beginning of the episode did a really nice job of capturing the feel of the original series, kind of the atmosphere of the market when we see the women who are being auctioned off, just sort of the framing of the shots, the way they're sitting around, kind of the color grading of the scene as well, and the situations that Archer in particular, but also Trip and Reed were finding themselves in. I thought that it had a real TOS vibe to it, more so than we've seen a lot of the time on the show.
No, I agree. I mean, you know, that whole section of the episode, you know, it also kind of made you wish that they had the ability, because they're on this water planet and they're on these different, you know, platforms that seem to be floating in the water and everything. So it just makes you think of what they could do with, you know, today's technology. But yes, I mean, just the costuming, the idea of this being a place where all kinds of transactions happen. You know, the fact that there's, you know, slavery here is, you know, kind of terrifying. And so, no, I think they do a great job with this.
Speaking of the market, I have a feeling that that alien who was auctioning off the women, Zajid is his name. I have a feeling the way that makeup came about is that someone in the makeup department called someone else a butthead, and that person said, hold my beer, I have an idea.
100%. That's exactly what happened.
Oh, man. So one other TOS feel that I got was the moment when Rajin is trying to escape on the Enterprise and she encounters the security crew member in the corridor who's about to pull out his phaser. It reminded me of in The Man Trap when the salt vampire disguised encounters Uhura. It's just that moment in the corridor and the sort of the moment of seduction that causes a pause.
Yes.
It reminded me of that. So
yeah, that's great.
All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on this episode and what's your rating for Rajin?
Well, I don't think anybody listening to this is going to think, oh man, Matt, we know he's going to give this episode because he loved it. No, this is not an episode that I love, but I do think it's obviously an important episode for the actual storytelling of the series. I think they do a great job of kind of creating a very eerie feel throughout the entire episode, right? I mean, and again, I think there's a real kind of horror aspect to this episode, which is kind of great. And so in all of that, I think they do a pretty decent job. And, you know, we definitely talked about all the places where I think this episode could have been improved by just some minor tweaks here and there. And I think that's the thing that maybe about Enterprise that we're seeing kind of throughout our discussion of it, right? A lot of the episodes are actually really good. There are just places where you wish they had pushed it just a little bit here and there, and you see places where it could be even better. And this is a clear example of a place where what they're doing thematically, what they're doing with the characters, what they're doing with just the storyline, and what they could be saying about larger aspects of our world could be even more enhanced with just a little bit more time or just a little bit more nuance here and there with dialogue or something like that. And so, you know, I'm going to be generous. I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5 liquid Trillium D cases because it's better than average, I think, but it's not great, right? And two, I can't discount this episode because it's actually very important for continuity of the rest of the season. So it's good. I like it, but it's not one I'm going to rewatch a lot. And part of that is just because I there are definitely places where it could have been improved. So what about you, Chris?
Well, are you giving it 3.5 because one of those Trillium D cases exploded and blew off?
There's only half of it left.
No, I agree with what you say. It feels like a puzzle piece that you've got to drop in place for the overall picture to come together. But after discussing it, I think I appreciate it more because of the character elements that we discussed and how it all plays into character development for the crew and some of the social issues that it does touch on. It's just when I watch it, I feel kind of like glass half empty when I walk away from it. Point. Like, it's not a bad episode, but it could be a lot better than it is with some tweaks like we talked about. I do love the fact that they trade black pepper, paprika, mustard seed, and cayenne pepper and probably some other spices to get the specifications that they need. It just seems like, because usually in Star Trek, you know, people want they want antimatter or they want something that's very hard to come by. And here it's just like, yeah, I brought my spice rack with me. You want it? So I thought that felt natural for Enterprise and it felt natural for Trip. Yeah.
How much for that spice rack?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to give this episode 3 seductive outfits.
Nice.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Rajin. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline there for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners. Of course, you can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose Warp 5, and that will come right over to us. and you'll find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not grilling up some succulent xanthan marmots, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, when I'm not doing that, they taste great on the smoker, by the way. You can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here in the network, you can find me outside all the Star Trek talk we do on the 602 Club, talking about all those franchises we love outside of Star Trek. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me with two shows. One's completed, called Owl Post, with Drea Kaufman about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and then doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, when you're not trying to find your way off of this, you know, floating platform with a lot of weird characters, where can we find you?
I'm learning to swim. I have to learn to swim to get off there. So
Just keep swimming.
Just keep swimming. Yeah. You can find me elsewhere on the network, of course, doing all the shows that I do with you. You can find me in social media. I'm on every platform. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. So wherever you are, drop me a line. I'd love to chat with you there and talk about Star Trek or college football or whatever else you'd like to chat about. And if you'd like to help us keep all of the shows on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network and get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. It takes a great deal of money and resources to produce and distribute these shows, and we would not be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now. And if you're not, I hope that you will do so. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to delving deeper into the expanse with you next time. I just hope we don't run into any zombies.
Well, Chris, that sounds terrifying, so I guess I better bet my shotgun or, you know, for some double tap, or maybe, you know, I'm going to need my baseball bat with the barbed wire wrapped around it, so I guess let's go.